You are listening to Kootenai Co-op Radio in Nelson, B.C. CJLY 93.5 FM on your radio dial. Welcome to Peace Watch Middle East, an exploration of peacemakers and peacemaking in the Middle East. Specifically, the Peace Watch Middle East series talks to people on both sides, Palestinians and Israelis. They may be engaged in nonviolent direct action, or in bicultural cooperation, or in the development of civil society. Last week, after the show with Netta Golan and George Rishmawi, I got an email that made me realize a lot of folks have a concept that I call the Time Magazine version of nonviolent action. According to this view, nonviolence begins with a good slogan painted on a big sign. Then you pack up a picnic lunch, gather up the kids, and head for the designated location. Rest assured, there will be lots of picturesque folks in colorful costumes, music, speeches, a nice outing for the family. This patronizing and superficial view is meant to convince us that nothing is ever really accomplished by nonviolent action anyway. According to this view, Congress and the Supreme Court and the Southern Sheriffs Association are going to give American blacks their rights anyway. The British were already planning to get out of India. King and Gandhi weren't really necessary. All you really have to do is write a letter to your elected representative and he will set things right. The further implication of this obvious lie is that if anything really is wrong, justice will require an army, some proper helicopter gunships, a battalion of tanks, and some fighter bombers. Listening to Netta and George makes it clear why the Time magazine vision of nonviolence is false. In the first place, Netta and George came to Canada straight from the Palestinian-occupied territories. This is where the difference between the violent approach and the nonviolent approach to the resolution of issues is being worked out today in our times. It's not really a foreground issue at the moment in the United States, although that could change soon. It's not an issue in Britain or anywhere else in Europe. It's certainly not an issue in the Congo or Colombia or Myanmar. But it is a major issue in Israel and the occupied territories. That, dear listener, is why we have spent 16 weeks exploring peace and peacemaking in the Middle East. Really, it's not a matter of picking on Israel. Israel and the territories, that's where it's happening. You know, we can work it out, but to kill or not to kill, that's the central issue of this part of the 21st century. Listening to George and Netta, you will come to realize that nonviolence is not for sissies. Those who choose the path of nonviolence can expect to be beaten, shot, arrested, imprisoned, and deported. Whether or not they may also be tortured, killed, or have their families subjected to the same atrocities depends, as we will hear, largely on their race and their religion. Race and religion aren't supposed to matter, of course. But don't take my word for it. See for yourself. It's not a simple matter. As I write this, across the Green Line in Israel itself, 509 veterans and officers in the Israeli army have refused to serve in what they call the War of the Settlements. More than 100 of them have been to prison for their views, some half a dozen times. Now, more than 200 Sheminitzim, or high school seniors, have also refused. They are now beginning to go to prison, too. No one has attacked their families or wrought havoc on their homes. Not yet. But someone purporting to be a rabbi has proposed, publicly and with impunity, that they should be executed as traitors. Netta Golan had her arm broken in a demonstration last summer. Caoimhe Butterley, an ISM activist from Ireland, was shot in the leg a couple of weeks ago. This is not a game for children. It's not a game of slogans and pretty speeches. In fact, it's not a game at all. Nonviolent action occurs by definition in the context of violence. Its presence allows us to measure the extent to which justice, compassion, and the civil society values of the combatants have been corrupted or possibly even lost. As outsiders, it matters to us because, as John Donne said, no man is an island. Just as much to the point is the observation by Allen Ginsberg, if you are not safe, I am not safe. We have to hope for the best for both people, because the solutions that Israelis and Palestinians find for their conflict today will be the solutions we carry forward tomorrow into our conflict with Iraq. We have to do better than F-16s and cluster bombs.
Until September, that was, you know, all this pressure was accumulated, and the land of the confiscation of lands continued during the peace process, during Oslo. And actually, all this dialogue, people thought that there is no problem between Palestinians and Israelis. They are fine now. There was a lot of money employed to create dialogue projects and peace camps between Palestinians and Israelis. And all of that was used to cheat people and tell them that the conflict in the Middle East has been solved after Oslo and nothing is going on. Meanwhile, expansion of settlements and land confiscation continued and arrests continued. And the biggest settler campaign was during the Oslo process. Like 84% of the settlement expansion took place between 96 and 2001. Another about 120,000 dunums, which are about 30,000 acres, have been given back to the Palestinians according to the agreement, and around 140,000 were confiscated to build settlements and bypass roads, confiscated by Israel. So, I mean, for Palestinians, they did not feel that because it was step by step, and for the world, they did not see that because there were joint activities, like sounds like peace activities between Palestinians and Israelis that are aiming towards coexistence, that managed to be like a smoke screen to what Israel is doing and cover what Israel is doing. So there is a need for a world wake-up about what's happening in Palestine. The land confiscation did not stop at all until this moment. And now it's even more with the wall that they are building around the West Bank. So ISM came about to enable the Palestinians who tried several times before to do nonviolent resistance and were suppressed very violently, as many other nonviolent initiatives in many other parts of the world. But Palestinians could not continue to resist nonviolently with this excessive use of power. And therefore, ISM came about to enable those Palestinians to resist nonviolently. When there are internationals in the front line of the demonstration, the demonstration I mean here by a peaceful demonstration without even stones, although relatively speaking, throwing stones at an armored personnel carrier is not violence, because there is no way that a stone will scratch even the tank or the armored personnel carrier. But when we have peaceful demonstrations, stone throwing is not part of it. So When there are internationals in front of this kind of procession or march, then it is less likely that the Israelis will shoot at the demonstrators. The Israeli army will be very much worried in shooting an international or killing an international, and those people voluntarily come and form like a human shield. We know that they have shot in earlier experiences, I mean, at internationals, like in April 1st, we were in demonstration with internationals, and all the front line was internationals, and they shot at us, and they injured 8. But there was that was not direct shooting. It was on the ground, and most of the people were injured because of ricochets and one rebound bullet.
Actually, just as a footnote to that, Kevin Nish, who is
there
in Victoria, was part of that that demonstration.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, and recently also the army shot at an Irish volunteer, Irish peace activist in Jenin, and shot her in the leg. And we strongly believe that they shot her on purpose. It was not an accident because they know her. She has been there since March.
I'm going to try to pronounce her name. That's Kaimhe? How do you say her?
Cuiva, yeah.
Cuiva.
It's written in Gaelic, actually.
Cuiva Butterly.
Cuiva Butterly, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, she's certainly been in the news from the international solidarity movement recently and even in some of the mainstream news.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, she has been in Jenin for a long time, and I'm very sure that the soldiers know her well enough to shoot her. I mean, they did not shoot her by mistake. This is not the first time she's shot at, but the first time it was maybe by accident, but this time it's deliberate. She's good now, I mean, but she might need another surgery.
What do you? I wanted to ask you.
What operation?
Operation. Yeah, surgery.
What do you think that means for your movement? The shooting of internationals. You've described in some detail the expectation that internationals provide a kind of shield even in a nonviolent demonstration sort of situation, except for the demonstration in Bejala, my impression is that there hasn't up to now, until the shooting of Cuiva Butterly, there really hasn't been gunfire directed at international volunteers. And
yeah, but there were beaten. I mean, they were beaten up by soldiers and by settlers and arrested and deported. But this is a message. I mean, for us, I mean, I see that. The ISM is really affecting the whole scene. I mean, it's not. I mean, this is a message for us that really we are doing something. Israel, I mean, the Israeli Military Institute is bugged because of our presence there, and they are concerned. It's not only that they are shooting or beating or arresting and deporting internationals, but in many cases they are turning away internationals from the airport.
I want to add something just to that.
Yeah, I'd like to get you to get your perspective on some of this too, Netta.
Well, it's just that it's, yes, we're there to serve as a voluntary human shield, but our purpose serves there's another purpose. I mean, Cuiva, there's no doubt that if she was a Palestinian, she would have been shot in the head a long time ago, for being in the soldier's face for so long.
Yeah.
So it's not that we've kind of lost our immunity. It's just that, wanting to get her out of the way meant shooting her in the leg. So it's still a preferable treatment than a Palestinian would get. But the thing is that the reason that Palestinians need international protection in order to conduct a nonviolent campaign isn't just that they need protection from the Israeli violence that's coming at them, because also in the first Intifada, like people, if Palestinians being killed, if unarmed demonstrators being killed would generate the amount of international pressure that this kind of systematic murder is expected to generate, then I know that that's a price that Palestinians are willing to pay. Many of the kids that go out throwing a stone at a tank, knowing that it's purely symbolic, that they're not going to chase the tank away with the stone, know that they're risking their life doing it, and that they're going to be killed in the process. The problem in this Intifada, the reason that I felt compelled to be present is that when this procedure of using snipers to shoot at unarmed demonstrators became routine, it wasn't met with the kind of outcry that you would expect. from within the Israeli community and from the international community. I mean, this has been going on for 2 years. You know, kids are killed, let's say, every other day, definitely every week, unarmed. And it has absolutely, it has no political, you know, effect. As soon as we are, as soon as there's someone with blue blood in the picture, as soon as there's internationals or Israelis in the picture, if we're attacked, which we know is a risk, you know, it's we are more protected than Palestinians, but we're still walking into a situation where there are armed, you know, there's a military force, and we're taking a risk. But if we are attacked, it creates huge, you know, waves. It gets a lot of attention. I mean, Kriva was shot in the leg. There's no way that we can talk about how many Palestinians were shot in the leg, you know, on the same day as Kriva, you know, or...
Well, there were several children who were killed that same day, Palestinian children, and there was no comment about
exactly,
that.
Even no comment on that.
Press.
But yet we do know about Kriva, maybe not enough, but we do. And if my arm was broken by, when my arm was broken by Israeli police, you know, I got on TV for having a broken arm, you know, at a nonviolent demonstration. And I, you know, it's just like ask the question of what could be more uninteresting than a Palestinian with a broken arm. You know, it just doesn't get the same, it doesn't have the impact. So that's I feel, you know, our role is to use the racism of the system against it. If it was just Israeli racism, if it was just that the Israelis are treating, you know, Palestinians as if they were animals that are, you know, that can be hunted, while internationals are, you know, are human beings that if you kill them, they have to you'd be, you know, held accountable, which is definitely the case. But if it was just that, then the international community would be stopping, you know, the killing of unarmed civilians. Unfortunately, the racism is a global, you know, phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody cares. Not nobody, of course, but the international community is not fulfilling its obligations under the Fourth Geneva Convention, which most of our countries are signatories of, under which occupied people have the right to it's the international community's responsibility to protect them and guarantee certain rights. That's not happening, and that's why. You know, civilians, international civilians, are coming, you know, to fulfill that role. And when we do that, and when these rights are being abused, and we're there, at least people on the outside hear about it.
I try to imagine that the UN would respond to what would happen if the UN did respond to the Palestinian appeals for protection. And I guess the picture that emerges from that is that the UN sends in blue helmets. They send in peacekeepers. And I when I think about the effectiveness of that and try to compare that to the effectiveness, it seems to me, of the international solidarity movement, it seems to me that it would be a shame to trade the work that the international solidarity movement has been able to accomplish for the kind of thing that the UN has never been able to do anywhere.
Well, the thing is that, you know, the UN's responsibility isn't just about sending in peacekeepers. Like, we know that...
We need peacemakers instead of peacekeepers.
Yeah, right.
We know that under the Fourth Geneva Convention... population transfer is illegal. All the settlements, all the Jewish settlements in the occupied territories, are a violation of international law. Bringing Israeli civilians into occupied territories is a violation of international law. Destroying property of the occupied people when not for military purposes, so expanding settlements, bypass roads, different policing operations and collective punishment is a violation of international law. So if we had, you know, if the UN were fulfilling its role, if the international community was fulfilling its role as you know, signatories of the Fourth Geneva Convention, saying that they are responsible not only to uphold these conventions, but to make sure that others do, then, you know, really the situation, the occupation, would not, you know, I don't know if there would have to be an intifada, because the occupation, which is based on, you know, illegal practices, wouldn't exist. So it's not only a matter of standing in between once the conflict has started, which, as you said, the Palestinians have asked for, and, you know, with all, like, thank you for complimenting our work, our forces are growing, but are meager compared to the needs. You know, we've this month kind of helplessly watched as an entire neighborhood in Rafah was razed to the ground because Israel wants to expand, you know, the buffer zone between Egypt and Rafah. And just every day for the past month, either a bulldozer comes in and bulldozes the house, or at night, you know, the homes are shelled and killing civilians inside. And we didn't have the manpower to have people, to have internationals in those homes, which I'm sure would have, you know, put in a very different element in that you know, at least brought this situation to people's attention, and we couldn't do it. And it was, you know, we had this plan, okay, we're going to send people, and by the time we sent or could send them, all those homes are gone, and people are sitting and are living, you know, under sheets in Rafah, in the city square, or in the town of Jayus. By the time, you know, we are demonstrating there, and the last Canadian that was from Saskatoon that was deported from there, Thomas Linner, you know, I remember we were planning the actions. It took us a few days to organize, and by the time we got there, all the trees had already been cut down. You know, we could protest the building of the wall on these people's land, but we could no longer try and, you know, protect the trees. So what
this,
I'm saying
this was
is...
The village, this was the village of the people who left, is that right, and then came back?
No, that's Yanun. This is a village that the so-called security fence, which is supposed to run along the border between, you know, Israel and the occupied territories,
right,
but also actually will be confiscating about 10% of the West Bank because it runs inside the occupied territories. So this is one of the villages where the wall is going, you know, basically confiscating all of their land and going to be built right up, you know, to where their homes are.
By the way, this village is a very old village, and it has been known as the village where, what's his name, Joshua, in the Bible, came from.
Uh-huh.
So it's in a very old village. I mean, I went to that village. The trees there, the olive trees, are at least, 2,000 years old. And they're just, you know, cutting them down, I mean, trying to wipe out the history of human presence there. And they want to build that wall, you know. It's not only the village that is going to lose land for the sake of building that wall, actually. It's one of many others.
Is this wall going to materially affect your ability to work together, of the ability of Israelis and Palestinians in the territories to be able to get together?
It's hard to imagine what the effects of the wall will be, you know, after it goes up. You know, since there are settlements in the West Bank, it would be very difficult for the Israeli authorities to say, you know, no Israelis can come into the West Bank. You know, that would be, you know, perhaps a positive thing if it meant, you know, obviously I don't think it's positive to create an apartheid situation, but if it meant, you know, no more settlements, at least we would, you know, that would be going a step further. But that's not what they're planning to do. Those settlements that are still inside the West Bank and will not be a de facto annex to Israel by the wall, because, you know, it's running in and kind of swallowing up settlements to be on the Israeli side of the wall, will still be inside. There will still be settler roads leading to them. So there will still be ways for Israelis to get to the West Bank. In Gaza, for example, that's not possible. The border between between the Negev Desert and Gaza is you know, it's like an international border, and Israelis since October 2000 are not allowed into A areas at all. So when we are in A areas, which is, you know, right now, A areas is like the Palestinian control areas. Right now, there's no such thing, at least not in the West Bank. You know, there's areas in Gaza where there's like besieged Palestinian controlled areas. But in the West Bank, everything has been retaken. But still, we're not allowed into those areas, and Israelis are not allowed, and we're not allowed into Gaza. So I can't get into Gaza. And, you know, I can't see them doing exactly the same. But they might. They might manage to do something like that with the West Bank, which is really scary, because Gaza these days, right, is a big prison to which, you know, there are also the Israeli authorities. And again, the international community is treating it as such by deporting, by allowing the deportation of Palestinians from the West Bank to Gaza, if, as they did in the case of some of the militants that were deported from the Church of Nativity or the families of the suicide bombings. It's like this exile prison that you're, you know, that people are sent to. Another, you know, another breach of the international law, not allowing people to move, to be transferred in or out of occupied territories. But, you know, as you know, for example, when that was the agreement in order to break the siege on President Arafat's compound and on the Nativity Church, it got the full support of the international community. Another kind of shocking, incredible thing is that the international community, for example, you know, was behind asking President Arafat to put in jail Ahmed Sadat and Fuad Shobaki. Like, there were people that were wanted by the Israelis, or, you know, Ahmed Sadat for being the head of a political faction. Mm-hmm. And the international community, right now there are British and American guards guarding these people that was demanded to be put behind bars without a trial, you know, and without a charge. Palestinian court has announced that both of these people, you know, there's nothing against them, and yet they're being held in prison, you know, contrary to international law, by international guards.
This question of the role of the international community is an interesting one, and I'd like to ask you more about that. I'd like to know more about the long-term goals of the international solidarity movement, and as I listen to you speak, it seems possible that it has something to do with beyond protecting the Palestinian population. In an immediate sense, it seems also to have something to do with perhaps trying to shame the international community into behaving as if it were serious about its own agreements. Certainly, Israel's not the only place where that has been a problem. The United States has been extremely recalcitrant about abiding by its international agreements and not very very prone to signing up for some of them. I wonder how you see, maybe specifically, how do you see an appropriate role? What would be an appropriate role for the United States in Israel and the occupied territories? Pardon?
An appropriate role, you mean?
Yeah. What do you hope the United States will do?
I don't know if this will be a bit naive answer, but this is how many people, I mean, believed at the beginning of the peace process, that the United States will be a real peace broker, you know, in the Middle East, an objective one, but unfortunately, they haven't been so far at all. I mean, since the beginning of the peace process until this moment. But with regard to the ISM long-term goals, our long-term goal is clear, and it aims towards ending the Israeli occupation to the Palestinian land, and having, you know, peace in that region. Now, you might find people in ISM who have different views, whether it should be one state for both people, or two states for one for each, or whatever. But the goal is to end the occupation and the military occupation, especially to the Palestinian land, through a nonviolent resistance that is organized by Palestinians and supported by internationals, and in some cases also jointly organized by internationals and Palestinians when it's possible, when it's needed. So it is basically designed to enable Palestinians to protest and resist the occupation nonviolently, and put the world, and hold the world responsible, for what's really happening in the Palestinian area, especially that there has been resolutions made by the UN and not implemented because Israel refused to implement them, and the United States is not putting pressure. Meanwhile, they are going to be forced on Iraq. And this is a double standard that we don't accept by any chance.
Yeah, I think that that this double standard that George is talking about, of having Israel, just not agree to a UN commission to investigate Jenin, for example, and nothing happens, nothing that can happen because, even when the United Nations decide to take any kind of action, it's always vetoed by the United States. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is a situation that's really putting, this is actually in a way what is motivating a lot of Americans and people to come to Palestine, because they recognize that these double standards are a message to people in the Arab and Muslim world, saying your blood is cheap. The international organizations are not going to protect, you or your people, while, they are going to enforce, the wishes of the West. And it's a situation where, in which, Palestine and Iraq are like these open wounds, for the Arab world, where they see civilians being killed or starved or both, every day, with the support of the international community, with the money of the international community, while any Western, and that includes Israeli, death is answered with even more of the same kind of force. So this is creating, a helplessness and despair and rage, which are the breeding grounds for people and movements, such as Bin Laden, where they are capable of flourishing in. If we had a UN that was functioning, without a veto, if negotiations in Palestine could have been something that that when negotiations were going on, that meant that international law was being implemented, and not that under the gaze of negotiations, more settlements were being built, there would be no need for people to resort, to violence, and no helplessness, no despair that would feed such violence. So I think people that are seeing our leaders create these hells that are going to, blow up eventually on the West, and if not on us, then somehow on our children, are very concerned about this. And that's why they're coming to make a statement to say, no, we're here to stand with the Palestinians for justice. And our hope is that if the people lead, like in the case of apartheid in South Africa, that was the grassroots movement that influenced the governments. And as you know, the United States was the last to come on board with the anti-apartheid campaign. And Israel never did, but if the people will lead, we believe that the governments eventually will have to follow.
You're listening to Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY 93.5 FM in Nelson, B.C. I'm Jim Terrell, and this is Peace Watch Middle East. I'm talking to George N. Rishmawi, a Palestinian Arab, and Netta Golan, a Jewish Israeli, who are co-founders of the International Solidarity Movement.
Is it possible that there is another government somewhere that could credibly play the role of an impartial third party? I mean, George says that the United States has tried to play that role, or that people expected the United States to play that role, but the United States is obviously an ally of Israel, and Israel is one of the United States' best allies, and so that expectation does seem like it's not very likely to bear fruit. I'm thinking particularly about the role that Norway played, or are there other countries that might have some credibility with both grassroots Israelis, with the Israeli people and with the Palestinian people?
Now, the Arab world recently had come up with a peace proposal from all the Arab countries, suggesting that if Israel withdrew from the occupied territories, they would normalize, you know, relations with Israel. It was completely ignored by Ariel Sharon. But I definitely think that both Europe is more credible as a broker in the eyes of Palestinians, or at least it was. You know, I mean, the more time that goes by with the world being compliant to what's happening, the less, you know, faith people have in the international community.
Mm-hmm.
But Europe still does have more credibility, and I think there are people in the Arab world that definitely have an interest in having, you know, peace in the region, and have made efforts in that direction. All of which are being ignored.
The Norway's role, actually, and I want us just to, if we can look at the United Nations resolutions and the voting. I would challenge if you find Norway voting in favor of the Palestinians one time. They did not vote any time for the favor of Palestinians, like or let me say in more clear words, against Israeli wishes. And that was very contradictory to what people thought about Norway, especially after Oslo, because this agreement is in Oslo and all of that. But I know a student in Birzeit University who made his master's degree about the role of Norway in the UN with regard to the Palestinian, Israeli resolutions. And Norway did not really play that positive role at all.
I see. Okay. Let me just change directions here. What kind of support is there for nonviolence among grassroots Palestinians?
Among grassroots, there are people who believe that it's a waste of time because they are not seeing, direct results coming out of it. But we know that nonviolence does not come with direct results. However, we have no, obstructions or objections by the Palestinian grassroots movement to our work. Even we have lots of support. Now, the grassroots, the NGOs in Palestine that are represented by BINGO, which is the Palestinian NGOs network, has formed together what is called the Grassroots International Protection for the Palestinian People, which is a GIPP, where ISM is on board and on the executive committee of this movement. And this is actually contains around 700 different Palestinian NGOs. And ISM is doing more direct actions than only having people to visit and show solidarity. Although we are called international solidarity, but we have international solidarity with the Palestinian people and with the Palestinian nonviolent resistance to the occupation. So there is a very, without the grassroots, without the local community, ISM cannot really function. And the fact that we are still functioning and our work is expanding, and we are maybe trying now to go to other areas in Palestine, is a proof for us that the local community is supporting our work. The activists, when they come to Palestine, they stay with Palestinian families in their homes. And the whole village is aware that there are internationals. The municipality knows, the local leadership in the village or in the district or in the area know that there are internationals, and They even facilitate their work sometimes. And even we did not find obstacles from the Palestinian Authority itself, except for one time, and it was a misunderstanding. After that, everything went okay, and they became kind of supporters for what we are doing. I don't say that they are hailing behind us or praising what we are doing in the newspapers or whatever, but they are not causing us any trouble any time that they can. I mean, it's easy in the Palestinian society to obstruct any kind of work, especially this kind of work, when we have internationals coming to be with families and support Palestinians. People can, and especially people with authority, can stop this work, but they don't want to because they don't think that it's a bad thing. They are very supportive.
Does the International Solidarity Movement have any presence inside the Green Line?
Inside the Green Line?
Yeah. Or
no.
Let me...
In Israel, you mean?
Since we're, like, the International Solidarity Movement right now is, I mean, it's a joint Palestinian international effort that's based, you know, to support Palestinian nonviolent resistance against the occupation. Basically, it's based in the occupied territories. And as you know, Palestinians from the occupied territories can't come inside the Green Line or into Israel. So our activities are... we can be where our Palestinian partners are allowed to be, but there are organizations inside the Green Line or from Israel that we're working with, in certain cases, just coordinate with when they come and work in the occupied territories, and when the local people, you know, are interested in Israeli presence. You know, we've worked many times together with Ta'ayush, which is a joint Jewish-Palestinian group from inside the Green Line, from Israel. So it's Palestinians with Israeli IDs and Jews with Israeli citizenship conduct similar forms of civil disobedience. They do food convoys to besieged villages and cities.
There were two women from Ta'ayush who came to Nelson to visit during, I guess it was toward the end of May this year.
Yeah, so they're doing very, very good work, and so are Rabbis for Human Rights, Women's Coalition for a Just Peace, Gush Shalom, Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, and when they're working with locals from the occupied territories, we've had chances to work together.
Maybe I'm reading between the lines here, but it sounds to me when you talk that you're talking about a cooperation between the Palestinians and internationals. So does that mean, Netta, that when you are doing that work, you see yourself as an international? You don't see the movement as a cooperation between Israelis and Palestinians bringing internationals in? You see the Israelis as part of that international support?
Yes. As far as ISM is concerned, that's exactly the case. The Israelis, you know, the Israelis are part of the international component. Because, I mean, in order to really understand this, you have to see, I mean, there were many, many joint projects, joint Palestinian-Israeli projects over the years of Oslo. Me and George met in one of these dialogue groups. In the beginning of the Oslo process, Palestinians were very open and interested in this kind of cooperation. When it became clear that the peace process and all these joint projects were being used as a kind of smokescreen, you know, that the world was being shown this image of, look how wonderful the problem is solved, they're solving the problems, when actually on the ground, you know, the occupation was reinforcing itself, the Palestinians started losing, you know, started talking about the issue of normalization and how it's a problem to present a picture of, you know, the problem is solved when the occupation is still, you know, and the colonization of the West Bank is going on, you know, full speed ahead. So in the beginning of this intifada, the network of Palestinian NGOs put out a call to stop joint projects, And actually, the partners in ISM, you know, I mean, they adhered to this call, but said, you know, it's not normalization if we're fighting together against the occupation. And that's something that they're that they have been doing. But that also requires the local community, you know, I mean, it takes the decision of the local community. As ISM, you know, if the local community that's organizing the resistance, you know, the nonviolent resistance is interested in the presence of Israelis, the invitation has to come from them, you know, to Israeli groups. But as individuals, anyone is welcome.
Okay. There are elections coming up, actually Palestinian elections and Israeli elections in January. What do you think about that? How is that going to influence
your
work?
Very optimistic. I mean, the situation in... there will be Israeli elections, I'm sure, unless something very unexpected happens. But the situation in the occupied territories right now is that it's illegal to move between one city and another, between a village and a city. So the villages surrounding a city, the villagers cannot get into the city. I mean, the president of a non-existent Palestinian state, you know, I mean, Yasser Arafat announced elections, interested in having elections, but that's not something that Israel or the United States are interested in, and it's not, you know, because it would, for example, require international observers and, you know, a kind of interference or presence in the occupied territories that they're not interested in. And I really think that there's no chance that they would make, you know, conditions for such an election possible. Not going to happen.
Okay. And what about a possible war in Iraq? Seems like war in Iraq is imminent. People are talking about it as early as the first week of December. How will that affect your work?
This will affect not only our work but maybe our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Palestinian areas, the war in Iraq does not only concern us because Iraqi children will be killed, but also because we are worried that Israel will be more free-handed, especially that there will be a focus, a world focus on the war in Iraq, and kind of ignoring what's happening in the Middle East or like in Palestine now. And this media blockout might cause us a lot of troubles. I mean, this has been evident for us since the first war in Iraq. There was curfew and house arrest in all of the Palestinian areas. And when other things, like when September 11th events happened, also all the media attention, you know, was towards that, and even afterwards the war in Afghanistan, there was a kind of media blockout in Palestine, and Israel was free-handed and doing whatever they want because no one is really now interested in hearing about it more than hearing about what's happening in Afghanistan or other places. So people are worried of transfer. People are worried about that. And if you talk to Palestinians about the options or the chances of transfer with the presence of Sharon, and I think that Sharon is going to be re-elected, then it's not very far, or it's not very impossible. So it's a concern, and I think this might require us as ISM to try to function more. But I cannot really know exactly what Israeli procedures are going to be there when there will be a war. Many people assume or expect that F-16s will be flying over our heads for a long time, you know, bombarding different areas, and that they will use it as a chance, you know, to attack and destroy more things and force people to leave. That will sound like a voluntary transfer or immigration, but it is actually compulsory.
Hmm.
Doesn't sound very optimistic, but I think...
No, it doesn't.
...how many people feel about it.
You've been listening to Peace Watch Middle East. I'm Jim Terrell, and I've been talking to Netta Golan and George N. Rishmawi, two founding members of the International Solidarity Movement. a Palestinian organization bringing Israeli and international volunteers together to help Palestinians resist the occupation nonviolently. I'm not going to play any Christmas carols today, but I will read some special Christmas news items from the Holy Land Christian Ecumenical Foundation. HCEF is an organization in the land between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea that serves Arab Christians, people whose families have been Christians, in some cases, since the time of Christ. In his message for the World Day of Peace, Pope John Paul II says that the Middle East crisis shows the need for the correct use of political authority. To read more on that story, go to the HCEF website at www.hcef.org. The demand on settlements must be Bush's response to aid request. Connie Whitlatch, Director of Churches for Middle East. United States relations with the Middle East are highly volatile at the time of this writing in early December, and this analysis and advocacy guide could be overtaken by events of either war against Iraq or terrorist action. Again, for more on that, go to the HCEF website. Bethlehem's Silent Night. Stephen Farrell in the Bethlehem Herald Sun. Christmas is canceled in the streets, if not the churches, of Bethlehem. As Israel announced its troops would remain on the streets of Christ's birthplace, and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat would be barred from attending celebrations, church and civic leaders announced festivities would be kept to a minimum. Palestinians perform Christmas carols at Israeli checkpoint. From Mohammed Asadi of Reuters. Kalandia, West Bank, December 16th. Under Israeli guns and gray skies, a Palestinian chorus sang Christmas carols on Monday at a military checkpoint blocking the road to Bethlehem. Bethlehem facing another sad Christmas. Bethlehem, West Bank. While the military occupation of Bethlehem continues, the missionaries of the Caritas Baby Hospital made an urgent appeal to the world to remember residents of this cage city. Ecumenical Service Prayer for Peace in the Middle East, the Holy Land Christian Ecumenical Foundation invites you to an ecumenical service of prayer for peace in the Middle East on Sunday, December 22nd at the Church of the Resurrection, Ellicott City. Bethlehem Faces Joyless Christmas by Matt Spitalnik, Bethlehem, West Bank, Reuters. The odor of tear gas lingered over the ancient cobblestones of Bethlehem's manger square long after an Israeli army patrol had rumbled past. Special Christmas appeal for the children of Bethlehem. The Holy Land Christian Ecumenical Foundation institutes this special Christmas appeal as part of HCEF's larger emergency appeal that will be used for job creation in order to encourage and assist Christians to remain in the Holy Land. And then finally, urgent prayer request from the BBC. It is the Christmas season, and many of you will be singing this beautiful and timeless carol, O Little Town of Bethlehem, How Still We See Thee Lie. Reverend Simon Oberst, the rector of Bath Abbey in the United Kingdom and a good friend of BBC, recently wrote, quote, I cannot sing this carol without thinking of the plight of my brothers and sisters in Bethlehem at this present time. To read more, go to the website www.hcef.org. Stay tuned for Mike Daglish and Sports Talk. We're going to go out today with a couple of tunes, Daniel Kulak's Last Light from his Life on a String album, and that followed by Peace All Over the Land from the Survivalist album Beginning Without End.
rest. Wherever I'm rest. Ease my tension and ease my stress. So you know, say if you have a good woman, you know, say you're blessed. You know why? Because a woman, them a dem a de ha de land, and me say woman, me say ya de me come from, and me say woman, some man can't understand, and me say woman, you know fi put your one pan, and me say woman, a big part of the plan, and me say woman, them in a good condition, and me say woman, me say me well want one, and me say woman, and me say, hold on, hold on, woman a me mother, me say woman a me wife, woman play a big part in a fi me life, she cook me food, she wash me clothes, every time she pass me say there she goes. Oh, she so pretty, me say, God, he knows. She manicure her, yeah, she pedicure her toes. Running a me garden, go pick her a rose. Yo, because a woman, them a de my daddy, and a me say, woman. Me say, yeah, them me come from, a me say, woman. A big part of the plan, a me say, woman. Them in a good condition, a me say, woman. Some man can't understand, a me say, woman. You know, people put your one pan, a me say, woman. Me say, the real black woman, a me say, woman. I help me sing, me song, me say, real good woman.